26. Bella and Shen walked up the steep temporary ramp to the waiting elevator car, where a small security retinue waited. It was easy going now, even for Bella's aging muscles and knee joints. The gravity was currently Janus ambient, but when construction was completed, the underlying machinery would be tweaked to induce a hotspot of 0.5 Earth gravities. It was a simple trick that the Fountainheads had taught the humans, one of the few gifts that had not involved the transfer of prior human knowledge. They'd already upped the gravity at Crabtree. The last centrifuge had been spun down and dismantled 3 years earlier. People had moaned and grumbled, but the medical benefits of permanent high gravity were too significant to ignore, and with the birth rate shooting up, the centrifuges could not have coped for much longer. Bella and Shen entered the elevator car with one of the security men and took seats. Soon they were rising, to the accompaniment of a tinkly rendition of The Girl from Ipanema. The car passed through an airlock into open space, and Bella looked down at the sprawl of underhull, imagining the deep foundations plunging through kilometers of ice to the spiken bedrock. If the Tier 2 advocates had their way, underhull would form a throbbing arterial bridge between the interior and the new territories scheduled to spill out across the other side of the sky. The upper works were much less impressive. A crane had winched the elevator across the 20-kilometer gap, and now it swung its boom to one side and deposited the little compartment next to a cluster of domes barely larger than the original underhull settlement. Bella and Shen passed through an airlock into a reception area. Furniture oozed into readiness, anticipating their arrival. A chair nudged Bella's ankles with a puppy-dog eagerness. She kicked it aside irritably. Nick Thale was waiting for them, as white-haired and patriarchal as a wizard. He was in his mid-50s, but had turned down all offers of rejuvenation. He wanted to wait another 20 years, he said, just in case there were any unexpected complications. "It's been a long time, Bella," he said. "You should come and see us more often. You should see how difficult it is to drag her out of her office, let alone Crabtree," Shen said. Bella shot the other woman a sidelong glance. Was that an attempt at humor, or just a bald statement of the facts? Perhaps she needed to revise her opinion of Shen. "There's enough to keep me busy, Nick. I trust you to keep a handle on things this side of the sky." "We do our best. How is Crabtree, anyway?" "You should pop down one of these days, take a stroll in one of the new biomes. We've got trees now, real honest-to-God trees, junipers, oaks. I never thought I'd see a tree again in my life. Gene edited from the aeroponics plant stocks." "No," Bella said, "that never worked. Turned out the plants we brought with us had already been hacked about to protect deep shaft patents, major chromosomal deletions, genetically impoverished. Not enough material to work with. So the trees, cultured straight from Fountainhead data, it was buried in the last batch of stuff they sent us, almost as an afterthought, as if they didn't think we'd find it all that interesting."
"I'd like to touch a tree again," Thale said wistfully.
"Then come down to Crabtree. I'll show you around. Things are buzzing now. It feels like a city." Thale grimaced. "A city on Sunday, perhaps, when everyone's left. Even the ice cream vendors. It's filling out more and more every year. The kids make a difference. The grandchildren. Blink and there'll be great-grandchildren. Kids for whom even the year of the iron sky is ancient history. Earth'll be like, I don't know, Sparta or Mesopotamia. A thing they look at in picture books before smiling and turning the page to something more exciting."
"You frighten me sometimes, Bella."
"I felt this way before I ever set foot on Rockhopper. As if the world was slipping away from me. It just got worse, that's all." Thale led her along the glass-connecting walkway that led to the Fountainhead Embassy, while Liz Shen stayed behind in the reception dome. Bella hoped her nervousness was not too apparent, but with every step closer to the aliens, she found her resolve crumbling. She had delayed this visit long enough, and would have continued putting it off had Jim Chisholm not requested her immediate presence. Chisholm was still technically her subordinate, but she had long ago learned that sometimes it paid to obey him. The embassy occupied the former landing site of the original Fountainhead ship. In some regards, it was still the original ship, but due to the dreamlike malleability of Fountainhead technology, it was difficult, and perhaps futile, to say for sure. The embassy was much larger, at any rate.
Its perimeter had encroached across half the distance between the original location of the ship and the hole, and it was much taller. But it had something of the same layered, glassy architectural style, with many chandelier-like arms curving upward to tapering spires, forming a thicket of refractive structures around a gherkin-shaped central core. Now and then subunits would arrive and depart, some of which were nearly as large as the original ship. Their mode of propulsion, like everything else associated with the Fountainheads, spoke of technologies far beyond human science at the time of the cut-off. The glass tube led into a domed vault in the base of the embassy. Layers of transparent structure surrounded them, aglow with the soft and calming violet light. As they walked across the floor, two cylindrical kiosks rose seamlessly from its surface. Thale and Bella stepped through door-like apertures in the sides of the kiosks, taking one each. Bella held still and waited for the kiosk to seal itself around her. After a moment, the cylindrical form contracted until the inner surface of the enclosure was only centimeters from her body. Seen through the optically perfect glass, Thale's kiosk had also shrunk down to something resembling a fat bottle. They started walking, and Bella's enclosure reshaped itself, bulging to accommodate the throw of her legs and the swing of her arms. It all happened so swiftly that Bella was never able to touch the glass. Thale led the way out of the vault and up a shallow helical ramp that led to a higher part of the embassy. As they walked, Bella knew, the external atmosphere was being swapped for the dense and poisonous broth of atmospheric chemicals necessary to sustain the Fountainheads. Gravity was also ramping up, but she felt none of that inside the suit's protective envelope. The helix carried them into what Bella had always thought of as the diplomatic reception area. It was a cavernous space that must have taken up a third of the interior volume of the embassy's central core, a room as large as a gutted skyscraper. Luminous pastel motifs ringed the space, suggesting, to Bella at least, vast stained glass windows of intricate abstract design. Angular structures plunged down from a distant ceiling, spiked and barbed and threaded with lines of soft illumination. It paid not to think about the gravitational forces struggling to rip them down. No Fountainheads were here yet, but, just as she had anticipated, Jim Chisholm was waiting to meet them. He still looked human, but she wondered how deep that resemblance actually went. Chisholm did not require any visible protective armor in the presence of the Fountainheads. On the increasingly rare occasions when he returned to Crabtree, Axford sometimes managed to run medical tests on him. He never found anything anomalous, nothing to suggest that the man in his care was anything but human on a cellular level, and Axford's tools were much more sophisticated now. But that was Chisholm in Crabtree, and this was Chisholm in the Fountainhead Embassy, and the two apparitions were not necessarily the same being. He smiled, spreading his hands in greeting and urging them further into the reception area. "I'm glad we finally talked you into this, Bella," he said, his voice sounding as clear and normal as if they were talking across a coffee table, rather than through toxic meters of alien atmosphere. "You always had great powers of persuasion," Bella said. "There's nothing to fear," he said. "Nothing in the world. They've got better at it since my day. It took them 3 days back then. Can you imagine that?"
"I imagine practice has helped."
"I suppose it has."
He wore loose, billowing garments in fawn and beige that, to Bella at least, were faintly suggestive of some minor theocratic order. His hair was longer than it had ever been on Rockhopper, combed back from his brow in thick waves. In 20 years he'd shown little visible evidence of aging, a few lines around the mouth, one or two creases in the forehead, but that was all. Such was the case with all the rejuvenations generally. Even when there were signs of aging, they appeared at a much slower rate than before. The half-moon glasses he still wore had to be an affectation.
"Bella," he said, "when all this is done, when they've made you young again."
She knew from his tone where he was headed.
"Jim,
it's not forbidden to move on, you know."
"I know you mean well."
He spoke as if Nick Thale were not there.
"No one expected you to change overnight after 13 years of exile. But how long has it been now since I came back?"
He held up his hand, smiling.
"Rhetorical question."
"Clearly."
"There's no law that says you have to spend the rest of your existence alone."
"No one ever said there was."
"You sometimes act as if there was."
They'd had this conversation enough times for Bella to know that Jim Chisholm was not talking about the two of them having any kind of relationship. He meant that she should find another man amongst all that were available to her. As if it was that easy. As if pulling out that knife in her stomach was a matter of childish simplicity. A knife buried so deep that it felt familiar and even, at times, comforting. He'd returned from the aliens gifted with strange wisdom, knowledge of things he barely dared speak of. Yet there were times when he appeared to know less about human affairs than he had before he died. He must have seen something in her face. "Forgive me. I didn't mean to pry." "I am what I am, Jim. I was like this long before we ever got to Janus. Nothing that's happened here has changed that. I'm sorry." "Don't be. Perhaps some other time, further down the line."
"None of us knows how far the line goes," he said. "Things change. Things that we thought would last forever suddenly aren't as immune to time as we'd imagined. It's just that there are times, like now, when we should all seize the moment. It was inexcusable of me to lecture you about your private life, Bella, but I hope you understand why I'm so concerned."
"Something's happened, then? Something that makes you wish I'd make the most of what I have now?"
"Something's on the horizon."
"Good or bad?" Nick Thale asked.
"Not good," Chisholm said,
glancing at Thale and then looking back at Bella,
"but nothing that need alarm us immediately."
Bella could have wished for better news, but she was glad not to have to talk about her arid love life anymore. Anything was an improvement over that topic of conversation. "Somehow that's not as wonderfully reassuring as I think you meant it to be," she said.
"What is it?" Thale asked. "Something's got them rattled. I don't know what exactly. All I've been able to gather so far is that it's something they found deep in the tube. Something that wasn't there the last time they looked."
"What kind of something?" Thale asked.
"I'd better let them tell you in person," Chisholm said. "They're on their way down."
One of the ceiling structures pushed its way to the ground. Three fountainheads emerged from a bulb-shaped aperture in the tip and moved across the floor. As they approached, gliding like ghosts, their many fronds made a whispering sound. They were 3 meters tall, slightly wider at the base. Under normal conditions, all that was visible was the outer curtain of blue tractor fronds that sprayed out from a central core, then curved down to contact the ground. These fronds, which were relatively thick and prehensile, supported most of a fountainhead's weight, enabling locomotion and the manipulation of its surroundings. The frond's constant swishing motion, even when a fountainhead was stationary, was believed to be linked to thermal regulation, respiration, and the transport of microscopic detritus from the inner layers. The next layer consisted of finer fronds, each only a millimeter across, with the partial translucence of fiber optic lines, and was only glimpsed intermittently. Flashes of red and green were believed to relate to emotional states. These finer fronds also functioned as more delicate manipulators for work requiring greater precision than that offered by the tractor fronds. The fine fronds evidenced a high degree of functional specialization. Some were furred with cilia of varying lengths that presumably permitted the fountainhead to detect sound and discriminate between frequencies. Some were tipped with tactile pads that were thought to be attuned to a wide range of chemical flavors. Other fronds were seamed with a dark lateral line that was believed to be the functional equivalent of an eye. Although the single line offered only a one-dimensional slice of its surroundings, the constant overlapping motion of many eye fronds presumably allowed the fountainhead to synthesize a rich visual landscape, akin to the ground-mapping radar of an orbiting spacecraft. Now and then they were capable of focusing their attention on a particular object of interest, and a number of visual fronds would be deftly interlaced to form a kind of basket-weave mesh about 30 centimeters across, perhaps enabling a high-resolution mode, as Bella's analysts had dubbed it. Within the curtain of sensory fronds was a second, smaller set of tractor fronds, rarely glimpsed, that might also have played some role in the exchange of reproductive material. Finally, at the heart of the creature there was a turnip-shaped central mass to which all the fronds were anchored, and which was itself supported 10 or 15 centimeters above the ground by the fronds. This central trunk contained, it was assumed, the alien central nervous system. A fringed mouth at its base served to anchor the creature to the mound-like pedestals that were the fountainhead's equivalent of stools, and which allowed the tractor fronds to be elevated and rested.
It was also speculated that the mouth permitted the ingestion of foodstuffs, assuming they were not absorbed directly through specialized frond structures, the excretion of waste, and, perhaps, the birthing of infants or the laying of eggs. Most of it was complete guesswork, though. Bella's analysts didn't even know the chemical makeup of the fountainhead atmosphere, let alone the biological adaptations that allowed the creatures to survive in it. No data existed on the physical conditions or whereabouts of the fountainhead homeworld, or how much time had passed since they had left it. Every attempt to interrogate the aliens on these matters had met with either polite silence or playfully cryptic answers. Perhaps even the fountainheads didn't know. One of them moved ahead of the other two. By its confident glide and the slight excess of ruby patterning in the sensory layer, Bella recognized it as McKinley, a name it had taken for itself. The other two were almost certainly Kanchenjunga and Daulagiri, although she could not yet tell them apart. She wasn't at all sure what to make of the fact that the aliens had chosen the names of terrestrial mountains. Was it a mocking echo of Craig Schrope's misheard fountains, or something completely innocent? No one knew. McKinley's tractor fronds parted like a stage curtain. The inner layer of sensor fronds interlaced to form a high-resolution array, which it held towards Bella for a moment before directing it at Thale. "Hello, Bella," the alien said. "It's good of you to come. We always enjoy your visits. You too, Nick." The fountainheads created human phonemes by rubbing fronds against each other and opening and closing temporary acoustic chambers within the frond mass. It was an audacious performance that nonetheless conveyed the ghostly impression of wind whispering through trees. Bella could never forget the abyss of profoundly alien cognition lurking behind the attempt at a human mask. "Thank you, McKinley," she said. "If Jim wasn't such a safe pair of hands, I'd be up here all the time, checking up on him." McKinley unraveled the higher resolution array and withdrew its sensor fronds back behind the outer curtain of tractor fronds. "You'll hear no complaints from us. We're very happy to have Jim up here. Still, it's high time you paid us a visit. You don't want to become too much of a challenge for us, do you?"
"Not at all," Bella said, "although I don't doubt your abilities for a moment."
"Make a good job of it," said Thale. "It took her friend so damned long to talk her into this that most of us haven't got the energy to face it again."
"We'll do our best."
The alien made an oddly familiar gesture, elongating two tractor fronds and clasping them together, like a person rubbing their hands before getting down to business.
"Anyway, the procedure itself is nothing you need worry about."
"That's a relief," she said, not quite telling the truth.
"But there is something we need to discuss. I believe Jim's already alerted you regarding our concerns."
McKinley rotated its entire body, giving the impression that it was turning to face Chisholm.
"Right, Jim?"
"I told Bella what you told me. I mean no disrespect, but the information was rather short on hard facts. I told her you'd found something."
"Yes, we have. Several things as it happens."
Thale shot a glance at Bella and asked, "Where exactly?"
"In one of the adjoining tubes," McKinley said, "not more than 4 light minutes from here."
"That's twice as far as we've ever been," Bella said, wondering whether the fountainhead caught the mild note of resentment in her voice. The aliens had been careful to dissuade the humans from venturing too far into the spiker structure, with vague warnings of the hazards that lay in wait for the unwary.
"There are sound reasons for the caution we advise," McKinley replied, with a hint of admonition. "You have done very well in the last 20 years, but your technologies are still limited in comparison to most of the entities you might encounter in the deep structure. Doors open and close without warning. We inhabit a relatively stable region, but other zones are subject to dispute that occasionally overspill into nearby volumes. You would not wish to become embroiled in something like that. But it's fine for you. Even we must act with caution. Of course, you are free to do what you want. We've never attempted to prevent your explorations."
To be fair, Bella thought, that was true. But the aliens were masters of dissuasion, and that had been effective enough. Except for one or two isolated incidents, quickly punished by her own administration, no human envoys from Crabtree had ever contravened the Fountainhead guidelines. "So what have you found?" she asked. Items of technical detritus, McKinley said. Paraphernalia associated with another culture known to inhabit the structure.
It flicked its tractor fronds, as if shooing away a fly.
They're messy. Wherever they go, they leave a trail of discarded junk. Who are they? The closest human equivalent would be musk dogs.
Are they dangerous?
Musk dogs are not in themselves belligerent or aggressive, nor are they exceptionally advanced by structure standards. They are just trouble. In their dealings with lesser cultures, they are indiscriminate and clumsy. They have caused great damage, great harm. Some cultures have proven robust enough to withstand contact with musk dogs, but most have been left wounded or even extinct.
Do you think musk dogs are on their way here?
The discovery of their detritus is certainly worrying. It indicates that they have sent scouting missions into this part of the structure. It may be that they have been routed, banished from other regions. Now that the uncontained are loose again, the balance of power is shifting across large volumes of the structure.
He had never mentioned the uncontained before.
Now you're scaring me, McKinley.
And me, Thale said. When exactly can we expect them to show up?
The alien's frond stirred languidly. Impossible to say, unfortunately. Relevant doors are closed now, but there is no telling when they will reopen. The Whisperers, another culture, have pass keys which permit some doors to be opened at their discretion. If the musk dogs talk to the Whisperers, or if they simply wait long enough until certain doors choose to open, it could happen tomorrow. It could happen in 50 years. But when the doors open, the musk dogs will arrive. You must be ready for them.
How?
You should evolve a societal stance that precludes contact. Ignore their temptations. Historical data suggests that there is no safe level of exposure to musk dogs.
Thale looked aghast. What if they come anyway? What if they force themselves upon us?
They won't,
unless you respond to their overtures.
What's to stop them? Bella asked.
Us, McKinley said. We'll protect you if the musk dogs are foolish enough to force contact upon you. But that is not how it will happen. They are shrewder than that, slyer. They know their limitations. They will attempt to insinuate themselves into your trust. They will cast aspersions on us. They will sully our motives, cause you to doubt our intentions.
You hate them, she said, marveling. We hate what they have done. It is not the same thing. They are simply runaway creatures that have somehow managed to acquire interstellar capability. Confined to their own niche, they would not be problematic.
I believe we should take McKinley's concerns seriously, Chisholm said, his arms folded into his voluminous beige sleeves. We've had 20 years to adapt to the idea that the Fountainheads aren't out to eat us or turn us into slaves. I told you they were benign the day I stepped out of their ship. And nothing that's happened since has given any of us cause to doubt that.
I know, Bella said, nodding to all three aliens. And I'll reiterate. We're all extraordinarily grateful to you. More than likely we'd be dead by now if you hadn't come along. And I thank you for warning us about the musk dogs. But please, see how things look from our side as well.
I'm always striving to do just that, McKinley said, with a sway of his tractor fronds that could have been taken for a huff.
It's just, you've given us so much, but you've told us next to nothing. Inside the cocoon, Bella felt a nervous prickle of sweat on her forehead. I appreciate that you have your reasons for withholding certain forms of knowledge. You know our history. You've seen the kinds of screw-up we're capable of making.
Since you mention it, McKinley said.
But we put our history behind us the day we left our own system. The old rules don't have to apply. We managed to survive for 13 years on Janus before you arrived, without wiping ourselves out of existence. We've learned to live with each other.
To a degree,
the Fountainhead allowed. You are, however, still prone to an alarming amount of factional squabbling. You do your best to conceal it from us, but we still see it. The musk dogs will also see it, and make it work for them. It's what they're good at. They're factional animals as well.
The as well chilled Bella to the marrow. But she forced herself not to falter.
I agree there's room for improvement, but that doesn't mean we have to be kept in the dark about everything. For all you know, more knowledge may help us achieve greater wisdom.
or it may rip you apart.
Please give us something more, Bella said. You've pushed further into the structure than we have. You've encountered other cultures. That much you've already told us.
We have, McKinley said.
Then tell us why we're here. Tell us why Janus dragged us across 260 light-years to this place. Tell us what it means to you. You must have some idea.
We have data, theory,
but you're not ready. When will we be ready?
In time. At the moment you are still absorbing the lessons of your own lost history. New knowledge, the kind you're asking for, could be catastrophically destabilizing.
How much time are we talking about, McKinley? Thale inquired.
Several decades. 50 years. Perhaps longer.
And if the musk dogs come sooner than that, how would that change things? Bella asked. McKinley shivered. A powerful ripple of his tractor fronds that exposed the ruby-streaked shimmer of the sensor fronds within. It was the only innately alien gesture Bella had learned to recognize. All the others, she felt certain, were a conscious mimicry of human action and revealed nothing about the alien's true emotional states, but the shiver indicated a profound agitation.
They will offer you the world, McKinley said. If you take it, you will lose everything.
They made her young again. Or at least younger. She had not requested a full rejuvenation, simply the resetting of her clock to the approximate physiological age she had been when Rockhopper first encountered Janus. Her decision might have been considered eccentric by some, given that the complete restoration of youth was also on offer. But Bella had enjoyed being middle-aged a lot more than she had enjoyed being young. She had felt good at 55, and it felt good to be 55 again, even though she still carried the burden of a further 33 years of memory, pressing against the limits of her skull like a migraine. She remembered little of the experience itself. Nobody ever did. She had said goodbye to Nick Thale and Jim Chisholm, and the fountainheads had escorted her into the base of one of the spikes that lowered itself from the ceiling. The spike retracted, transporting her deeper into the embassy. Presently the aliens brought her to a kind of garden enclosed by glass, a place of running water, rock pools, wind chimes, and simple plants with a delicate blue-green luster. The fountainheads remained behind the glass, pressing their ever-moving fronds delicately against it. Unaccountably, she was reminded of something she hadn't seen for 40 or 50 years, the whirling brushes of a car wash sliding against a windshield. The cocoon opened, allowing her to step out. The air was breathable and pleasantly scented, somehow encouraging deep inhalations. The burble of water and the tinkling of the chimes induced an overwhelming sense of ease and well-being. She supposed that the aliens had dredged the human psyche and extracted the parameters for a maximally relaxing environment. Knowing that it was engineered, the product of conscious and quite possibly ruthlessly pragmatic design principles did not lessen its soothing effects. Some chemical influence in the surroundings eased her into a state of serene acceptance, blasting away the last residues of trepidation. The aliens instructed her to disrobe and lie down in one of the larger rock pools. The rock was soap smooth beneath her skin, and the water lapped and burbled gently against her shoulders. It was cool enough to feel invigorating, drawing the blood to her skin, but not so cool that she could not have imagined spending all day in the pool. But she soon felt a pleasant, seductive drowsiness. She had no will to move, no desire to think. She was aware, without any sense of alarm, as the water rose to cover her completely, and when they brought her back she retained some murky recollection of drowning. But there was nothing in that memory that felt like fear or anxiety, only a serene acceptance, a childlike sense that she was in wise hands. She did, however, remember a dream. It was a dream of an all-surrounding darkness, and of a child lost in that darkness, a girl lost in the snow, in the thin air and cruel cold of a night somewhere in the Hindu Kush, hoping and praying for the lights of rescue to pierce the darkness. Eventually a light swelled to the brightness of day, and Bella was back, lying in the shallow, burbling water. She held a hand up towards the false sky, and saw that the aliens had done all that she had asked of them. But she had smuggled something of that cold back from the dream, and when they asked her to stand she could still feel the chill in her strong, new bones.
"It's time to go home now, Bella,"
McKinley said, and for a moment she thought the alien meant Earth rather than Crabtree.